are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley coming to you today from Mexico City, which I have to just say is amazing. That I could come to you, but also that I could be here. Both of those facts are amazing. And you're here for another episode of The View. We have special guests we'll introduce in just a moment. But first, our regulars. Hey, Aisha.
Good morning. I'm Aisha Hauser. And actually, this morning I'm in Bellevue at East Shore Unitarian Church. Usually I sign in at my home in Seattle, but it is bright and sunny here. It's been sunny all week. Spring is visiting, which is great. So I'm chipper this morning.
And good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino joining you from Peekskill, New York, where, it is full on spring here. And this is natural light that you see around me. It's really quite wonderful. And it's good to be with you all.
Jessica?
This is Jessica Star Rockers from Seattle, Washington. And also beautiful weather out here lately. Really beautiful spring. I will be on Facebook and on Twitter and on the YouTube chat. You can find me at CLFUU or hashtag The View. Send questions and I will get those to the hosts.
And we just want to lift up healing prayers for Christina Rivera, our other host, who is recovering from a cardiac incident, which she suffered at the board meeting last week. She is in good health. She's recovering, but we want her to be fully, fully recovered before she exerts herself. So sending out love and care to Christina. And Aisha will be heading out next week for her own health care. So it's a group of people taking care of ourselves here. So before we introduce guests, I did just want to say how amazing it is to be in Mexico. I kind of came here on a fluke because Jake Morrill, who's on the CLF board, came for a sabbatical and had extra time and offered me a free place to stay up in San Miguel. And I thought, well, while I'm there, I'll just go to Mexico City because I've never been in the mountains. What is most amazing to me here is being in a country where the history is not told from the perspective of the warlike intruders. And it is all told from the perspective of the conquistadors came, we fought, we resisted, and we're okay again. And so you go to the museums, you go places. There's one whole museum just about American invasions into Mexico. It's really amazing to be here in a level of understanding that I hadn't really got that would come to me. And it makes me want to go to a lot of other places, I have to say, where I've not believed the history, but it's still in my head. And so to be here is just, it's changing me. I'm just amazed. And I don't even know Spanish. I'm here completely as a turista. But Aisha, were you trying to log in?
Looks like well, because I lived in Cartagena, Colombia for 2 years. And I just loved it. And it was the first time that when I referred to myself as an American, one of my Colombian friends said, "We're all American. You're from the United States." And I'm like, oh my, I got correct. And it's true. And so it's I highly recommend that. I wish, you know, every person in this country can experience actually living, not just going for a week or two, but really living among folks in different countries. Because it genuinely, I'm from another country, so I kind of had it, but I had never lived in any part of Latin America. And I would go back in a second. I just need somebody to give me a job in Colombia and I'd go back in a nanosecond.
Well, of course, we've had Jorge Espinel working out of Colombia for the last 3 years at the CLF.
I love so. Jorge.
Indeed. I really, the level of vitriol coming at Mexico, being here, I'm realizing, oh, we're doing that the same way that we're doing reversals on who's violent and reversals. This is us being violent to this place and then framing them as being, I mean, it's just, anyway, I commend it to you. I had only gone to the coast before, and that's a whole different tourista thing. So, Michael or Aisha, anything you want to mention before we jump into our topic of the day?
I do want to, just real quick, because there's been an interesting conversation about plastics and green and, you know, supporting the earth. Yeah, all of that. And I want to lift up Reverend Teresa Soto, who said, you know, this whole give up straw thing is really insensitive to folks who genuinely need to use straws in ways that are make drinking accessible. And so I think it was, and Michael, I saw something that you posted, and I think it's important that when we're, I can do it too, is beyond this mission of it's one way or the other and there's no middle ground. And so I learned so much from Reverend Teresa, and this is one more thing to just stop and be mindful in a different way and kind of have a more a complete picture. So I just wanted to lift that up.
Yeah, I'm actually participating this week in the Earth Week Plastic Challenge, trying not to use single-use plastic all week and failing at that. I will. Part of the interesting part of it is reflecting on the parts where I have to fail, right? I have to take my blood pressure medication in the morning and it comes in a single-use plastic vial. And I'm not going to not take my medication for the week because we're taking care of our health here on The View. And, you know, so reflecting on the places where I am failing, but reflecting on the places where people are getting awful judgy. And like there's this fundamentalism around plastic. And, you know, my post was about the fact that we have a box of straws at the congregation I serve in the coffee hour supply closet. And it's specifically there for people who need straws in order to have something to drink as a matter of accessibility. Because we had a member who was in a wheelchair and who did not have the hand coordination to be able to drink anything unless it was through a flexi straw. So we have a box of straws for him. And I'm not going to apologize for having a box of straws in the closet. But that said, that box of straws, at the rate that we use it, will last our congregation 5 years. I mean, it's not a giant box of straws. It's a normal box of straws, unless we, you know, unless we happen to have a great influx of people with accessibility needs, which would be super. I'm also, you know, I've been commenting a lot on people getting judgy about things like peeled fruit in plastic containers or pre-chopped vegetables. And every time I see someone going, oh yeah, well, nature, if only nature made a wrapper for an orange that wasn't plastic, and really being very judgmental about it, I have to note that I know lots of people whose hands can't peel an orange. And so you can look at that as a waste of plastic, or you can look at it as making fresh fruit accessible. And if you don't need fresh fruit to be accessible, you should just not use it. And, you know, that, and people are, but, you know, it's true. And so I don't use that because most days I can peel an orange. But I know people who need it. And I don't use straws because I hate them. But I know people who need them. And who don't have the hand strength to put a little brush down a straw to clean it either. So. Yeah, it's been an interesting week.
I'm not doing the challenge, but I'm in the Facebook group just to watch other people and learn, because it's all, some of it is stuff I will do, you know, and it would be hard to be doing it here in Mexico, I'll say, as a traveler. I'm not at home. I don't have all my containers and everything, you know, so, but I'm definitely taking notes, and I think it's inspiring to see people try and to see where failure is just built in for on medicines or CPAP machines or whatever. So anyway, well, we have some special guests today. We started a mini series that we'll be slowly working our way through, it seems, but we really wanted to bring on Unitarian Universalists who come from different theological spiritual identities and talk to them about those identities. And today we're really focusing on UUs who are hyphenated as Jewish Unitarian Universalists, or I don't know if you actually say you are hyphenated, that will be a place to start, because everybody's identities are different in these regards. So I'm excited to be joined by Leo Hart-Landsberg and Marty Keller. And so maybe you could just start by introducing yourselves and say how you describe your spiritual identity. Leah, you want to start?
Hi, good morning. I'm Leah Hart-Landsberg. And my Unitarian Universalist Jewish identity is something that I inherited from my family of origin. My mom grew up Episcopalian and came to Unitarian Universalism as an adult. And my dad grew up Jewish and then has evolved into more of a secular Jewish identity. And so I come from a family that is both. And as a UU minister now in adulthood, I feel no less Jewish for being Unitarian Universalist. There's a interesting narrative, I think, in our UU movement that maybe we can talk about later, that I think sort of views people who come from Judaism as interlopers. And one of the ways that I experience myself challenging that is that as much as it's a blessing to have people come to Unitarian Universalism from a variety of locations, I grew up UU and I grew up Jewish. And I've always found a very rich agreement. Sometimes there's challenge within a wider agreement, but an agreement between Unitarian Universalist and Jewish ways of living and learning and loving and engaging with the world. So it's a pleasure to be here to talk about it more. Thank you.
And Marty.
Well, I'm another brought into Unitarianism because it was before the merger by my parents who, after World War II, being more secular in their outlook anyway, decided that they basically did not want to be Jewish anymore. I mean, and neither one of them from then on actually identified as being Jewish in ways that were kind of painful, especially my mother, you know. For example, my children bought a mezuzah when they were teenagers, or they thought they bought a mezuzah. It's the thing you put over your door that has a scroll in it. And my mother refused to go through the doorway because she didn't understand why her children and grandchildren would be Jews anymore. Well, the irony was that my kids had not actually bought the whole mezuzah, just the container, because to buy the whole thing costs a lot more money. So my mother was objecting to an empty container. So it was me as an adult who actually exposed my children to more Jewish practices. I've been married twice, both to Jews, Reform Jews, and two of my children have, as they became adults, have actually returned to Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism. One of my sons was bar mitzvah that way. So like Leah, I've been here and I didn't see any inconsistency in it. So when you ask spiritual or religious affiliation as a Jew, nope. It's been a deep ethnic cultural identity. It's an identity I think that I couldn't escape if I wanted to, and I don't choose to. I am a Jewish Unitarian Universalist.
Well, Marty, when you say it's not a spiritual or religious, do you mean you don't celebrate Jewish holidays or practice?
We celebrate Jewish holidays. Like, and by the way, I did a thesis 18 years ago, so I might start peppering with the things I found out, even if they're old. Most Jews in this country have sort of a symbolic relationship to holidays. And so, yes, you know, I have exposed my children. We've done seders. We've done all those things. But when I've done those belief-o-matic tests, how many of you have done that recently, the current version? My score in Judaism was below 50%. And my husband's score was 90% liberal Christian. And he's a person who grew up totally Jewish. And then both of us had very respectable scores, thank God, in Unitarian Universalism. But I actually taste more theologically Quaker than I do, and quite a bit secular humanist. But most of the Jews in this country, I think Leah might agree, actually, you know, theologically, are probably not as doctrinaire as one might think. So.
Interesting. Marty, I wonder, one more question for you. Wait, I'm reading. People watching can hear but can't see. Well, I'm glad you can hear. That's the main thing, although we look good. But hopefully you'll be able to see soon, too. Marty, I wondered about the kind of anguish that you described from your mother. Do you think that was from living through the Holocaust, or do you think it was about internalized anti-Semitism? Or I'm just curious why you think into that.
If you look sociologically after World War II, there were a lot of Jews that there was a real assimilation move. You know, I think they wanted, you know, there was that Protestant Christian Jew, Judeo-Christian assimilation. My mother grew up in a small town in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, and I do believe there were just a handful of Jewish families. So I'm sure she got a big dose of not feeling like she fit in. And I mean, it was fairly extreme with my mother. She did the nose thing. As she and when my parents divorced, she dropped the Greenberg because she didn't want to have my father's name, and she didn't go back to Stein because she didn't want a Jewish name. She went down to her middle name and called herself Lucille Charlotte for the rest of her life. I mean, you're talking about a lot of pain. Thank you. I mean, a really just a lot of denial of that. And I think it must have stemmed from some pretty big wounds when she was growing up.
Well, speaking of pretty big wounds, and we'll get back to Unitarian Universalism, but this is the world we all live in. We're all watching a horrific rise in anti-Semitism globally and in the U.S. We just saw a demonstration down in Georgia with swastikas. We saw Charlottesville. We obviously have a president who's not denouncing white nationalists. And so I'm interested in that intersectionality of the anti-Black and anti-people of color racism and the anti-Jewish racism that those groups lift up. Leah, I wonder if you wanted to start with this, because I think that it's just a really important kind of where we are today as we talk about these identities. They're not neutral identities in the world that we're in.
Right. I think you did a good job of painting a picture about where we are nationally and even globally in terms of rising anti-Semitism and a lot of other forms of bigotry. And I think if we sort of zero in on Unitarian Universalist community life, we see the same trends that I'm not aware of people in Unitarian Universalist congregations who are spray painting swastikas on their pews. But having these ideas be so normalized and so quickly accepted in a new way. I'm not saying that anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry are new, but they're acceptable in polite conversation in new ways. And we see how that impacts congregational life and how people in our movement are emboldened to discount Jewish wisdom and to question the motives of Jewish people who are trying to make a home in Unitarian Universalism or have been doing that. So I think that I think we could draw a bridge between, like you did, which is why you segued this direction, but to just note that you've created this bridge between this global context of anti-Semitism and then what Marty is saying about the like really deep personal places of pain that Jews and other people from marginalized locations carry. And something else, Meg, that you talked about earlier about your experience of being in Mexico is sort of being able to look at all of these reversals and to look at where is violence coming from and then who gets blamed for it. And I think that much in the way that, you know, immigrants, Mexicans, Muslims, people of color, Black people who are minding their own business, often unarmed, often children, Jewish people are getting blamed for bringing in metaphoric and literal disease and violence, that they're victimized by it and then blamed for it at the same time. And I think that where I would like to see the conversation evolve in Unitarian Universalism is instead of arguing about whose identity location is more authentic and more pure, that instead we make some points of connection here and talk about and create for ourselves an actual power analysis of what kinds of people are being shut out of which conversations, and then whose actual identity and whose actual bodies are imperiled by that being shut out.
Yeah, well, Leah, since you took the bridge further than I had, let's just keep going there. How do you see that kind of, because you said we're seeing not burning swastikas, not lifting up swastikas, but we are seeing a rise of anti-Semitism in polite conversation. I would say it's not polite, but in regular, you know, white people conversation, in our congregations, how are you seeing that increase? What are you observing that's elevating in Unitarian Universalism?
Right. So you're questioning, you know, how do we even define what's polite, right? And that's a really good challenge to that. I define polite as something that people either don't object to or don't feel empowered to object to, right? And there's a lot of really loud silences in there. I think in Unitarian Universalism, I serve in a small city in Wisconsin, in Appleton, Wisconsin. And where I live is not a Jewish area. There are Jews are really far, few and far between. And so in the congregation I serve, there's some interest in Judaism, but there's not much experience with it. A lot of folks don't know Jewish people and haven't experienced Jewish ritual or, you know, even a passing Hebrew word, et cetera. And what I've noticed over the last few years is a real concern if we try to bring elements from our Jewish source tradition into worship, that there are people who greet that with curiosity, with delight, and are eager to build on that and incorporate that into their spiritual path. And then there are those who are really interested in us drawing a line around that so that we don't veer too far towards that. And I feel, as someone who's been in ministry for 9 years, that sentiment is increasing. And I'll also say that I find in collegial conversations with professional Unitarian Universalists who serve our congregations or our movement in professional ways, that an increasing trend that when there is a conversation on the table about Christian supremacy, about if it exists, about how it exists, about how it is that we as Unitarian Universalists might seek to be accountable to our Christian DNA, the ways that we currently are Christian, the ways that we currently aren't part of Protestantism, the way that does and doesn't impact our identity, sort of, et cetera, et cetera. These are really important conversations. But I've noticed they often happen in ways that when they get tense, and they, spoiler, they always get tense, that the tension gets blamed on people from outside of Christianity. And often it gets mapped out onto Jews. And as someone who doesn't come from a Christian spiritual or theological or congregational background, although I have it in my DNA further back, I often think like, well, wait a minute, this is a Christian conversation among people who come from Christianity. I'm not sure why the summative comment is always that, you know, a little too close to, well, the Jews are ruining it all for comfort.
So thank you, Leah, for that, because I actually had a different question, but I want to continue with that. So in the interest of transparency, I was raised Muslim and I've been part of a Jewish family for 27 years. And my husband was bar mitzvahed and all of his parents and grandparents came from both Ukraine and Germany. And so my children, who are young, well, my daughter's young adult, my son is almost there, very much grew up with their Jewish heritage, secular Jewish heritage, not as much from the Muslim side. But I want to, so I just need to say that I appreciate just loving so much about the Jewish culture. So I actually have two questions, but before I get to the one I initially wanted to say, because I also watching the conversation about there's a term someone threw out about Christophobia, which I don't quite understand it, and I don't necessarily experience that, but I think Unitarian Universalism is richer by actually affirming our sources that aren't just Christian. So this defense of one faith has been also peculiar to me, because I don't think there's necessarily, I think let's expand our imagination and not blame one group of people, because I've also, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, we have actually a person who is part of a Jewish family who said, I can't handle this place being called a church anymore. So I'm out. Like, you know, there hasn't even, people are more than willing to argue about the words white supremacy, but don't feel that the word church has any more meaning to it, you know? So, but yet we're willing to assign words. So I appreciate that lifting up. But I wanted to ask both of you, because one of the things that I see is, do you, that I experience as part of I think the anti-Semitism is a conflation between being angry at the human rights abuses of Israel, of the state of Israel, with the Jewish people. And I think that's an important distinction because, like I said, I've been part of a Jewish family now for over 27 years. And I mean, my sister-in-law is like completely, you know, pro, so is my husband. I mean, we're pro human rights. And so there's, I don't think people separate that distinction enough, that really, I think there's a conflation of blaming every single Jewish person on the planet for whatever it is the Israeli government does. We don't like it when people, you know, our United States government's going off the rails. You know, I don't want to be blamed for that. So if you want, either of you want to respond to that.
Yeah, I would like, thank you. Thank you for two things. Thank you for bringing up the church thing. We have to really circle back to it because it's so critical, you know, but to answer that thing, I thought it'd be interesting to share with you what the Pew Research Foundation found out about what it means to be Jewish. Because it was not very many years ago. So the biggest thing was remembering the Holocaust, 73%. Leading a moral or ethical life, 70%. 56% working for justice and equality. 43% of the Jews say that anything to do with Israel is of that supreme importance, right? So that's the other thing, is assuming that that's what drives us as Jews. And that's what, you know, so that's the one thing I want to say. And to just echo what you said about, you know, no. I don't like a lot of what's going on in Israel. But when I was a minister, I pretty much got trolled in my congregation for 2 years by somebody who kept pressing me. It was before Facebook. It was email. And I have to say, my congregation did nothing about it for a couple of years. They thought that was legitimate, that because I was a Jewish Unitarian Universalist clergy person, that I should be hounded specifically about what I thought about Israel, which then meant what kind of person I was. And I refused to go there. And it took a long time. We actually had to get an injunction against this person, ultimately, to shut this person up. So, yeah, very, very hard.
Well, let's just, Marty, let's stay with the church thing. Right. That is a shorthand for, I think, a much larger conversation about identity, but it's certainly a very visible one. I mean, last year at GA, we said Standing on the Side of Love is an inappropriate name for a campaign that's about inclusion and stopping oppression because it's oppressive. So it seems to me like the word church, which is part of CLF's name, a similar case could be made that it's actually an oppressive word, and why would we want to put it out front?
Well, so when I did my master's thesis at Emory University a number of years ago, and it's interesting, I chose to study Jews within the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Atlanta while I was in a Methodist seminary, probably the only Jewish UU they ever had seen or since. What I learned was that people who came into that congregation, and I think it's fair to extrapolate that this is true, understood that we came from Protestantism. They understood that. They knew about the Transylvanian connection. They knew all of that. Some people were a little bothered by the Christian holidays, but they could choose to opt out. You know, they didn't have to go on Easter. They didn't have to go on Christmas. Most of the Jews were interfaith, intermarriage, Christian, Jewish. And I think that's still true. So they had already made their peace with it. And so that was no problem. The one thing that almost consistently would have been the reason and was the reason for people either not crossing the threshold or leaving was the word church, for all of the pain that's associated with it. Before the Inquisition, before, you know, the popes, the, you know, Luther, when some of my colleagues were, you know, celebrating Reformation Day and Luther's birthday, and not a word about the things Luther said and meant and about Jews, extremely painful. And I just concur with you, Meg. It really, words matter. So UU Congregation of Atlanta isn't even a church, but when I was there, people would make a point of telling me that it was too much to expect for them to call it a congregation. And what other way can we describe it? And it's too hard for us to, you know, change the words out. Well, we change a lot of words out, don't we? Because language matters. Yeah. So.
Yeah, Marty, I just from my perspective here in New York, I serve a congregation that I would say is at least a quarter folks from Jewish backgrounds, many of whom are in interreligious marriages and relationships, and who came to Unitarian Universalist that way, but not all of whom did. You know, some of whom are like you and Leah, lifelong Unitarian Universalist Jewish people. And some of them are folks who just came our way for other reasons. And it's probably 20 years ago now, the congregation had a very big conversation about its name, and chose to keep the name Fellowship. We're the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Northern Westchester, because that's what it was named in the Fellowship movement when it was founded 60 years ago. But because at that point, they saw their other option as church. And many people said, if this had been the Unitarian Universalist Church of Northern Westchester, I never would have come in. And that was heard. Fellowship might have its own set of problems we can talk about at a different date, and why they didn't go for congregation, I still to this day have no idea. It was definitely heard here. And it's front and center that's why we call ourselves Fellowship, because the word church is, it's more than off-putting. It's felt as oppressive to many people who, by and large, are Jewish. So I just want to lift that up from my experience here in New York. It certainly is the case here, too.
Leah, how is it in Appleton? I'm curious.
I serve a fellowship. It's a congregation that was founded as part of the fellowship movement. And I think that works for the congregation I serve is, I live in Wisconsin, so there's a lot of Catholics and then almost as many Lutherans. And so a lot of folks are coming from a place of reacting to what didn't work in their background. And like fellowship, they see that as a clean slate word. And for folks who come from outside of Christianity, especially religious minorities, and some folks who just come from secularism, that's not particularly tied to any other tradition, that seems like a word that's that strikes that balance of being recognizable as religious, but also enough of a blank slate that people can bring to it what they want. And, you know, one of my attitudes is that as a minister, I'm always really careful to use language about fellowship. And as a congregant, I invite people to use whatever word feels right to them, and to accept that, and to help us all get used to the reality that words matter and that we have different relationships with them. And that's okay. And that's, in fact, even a strength. I think that, as someone who came of age in Unitarian Universalism, when the language of reverence conversation was really active, I find that a beautiful and helpful contribution to our movement. And I think it also brought to the forefront a poverty of imagination around what kind of language might be considered religious. And I would like to see us continue to explore ways that we can express our theology, our religious impulses, what we believe, what we might like to believe, but to think expansively about what kinds of words can we recognize as spiritual or even claim for the first time as spiritual.
Well, Leah, I love the fact that you talked about individual decisions about language versus corporate. You know, I'm sitting here in the South. That's where I've done my ministry for 20 years. And there have been a lot of conversations in the small congregation that I served in North Georgia about how it could had to be church, because that was the only way we would be credible. See, that's, you know, that when you hear that, and then that the discussion is over.
Which is so ironic, because the American South is so Jewish, right? In this way that I didn't understand until I lived in rural Florida, right? But the American South is really, really Jewish. So it shows who's at the seats of power in those conversations to imagine even having a discussion that concludes with the idea of church being the only appropriate word. Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, but when you say when I hear that the only way we're going to grow in the South is to be church, is to go with the Christian source, that's when the hurt and upset happens. But I love your notion that people can call it what they wanted, and also maybe practice calling it what other people want to call it at the same time. let's practice using the words.
So I was curious, Leah, when you said, you know, people didn't want too many Jewish elements in worship. My experience has actually been the opposite of people want elements without really knowing what they mean, or, you know, in kind of an appropriative way. And so I'm curious for both of you as ministers in largely, you know, settings where people come in from a huge variety of places, how you feel like Jewish elements can most meaningfully be present and bring gifts into worship. I don't care who starts.
Yeah, I think that's true too. I kind of want to have it both ways. I think that some folks who come from Christian traditions that don't stress a lot of scholarship and biblical scholarship, they sometimes simply haven't encountered the fact that the Christian Old Testament stories are in fact alive and contemporary Jewish stories. They just haven't, that's just a new idea to them. So if I say, oh, it's the Passover and let us together examine the story of the Exodus, then sometimes people get really triggered and they think like, but the priest used that story to harm me spiritually. And the answer to that is yes, and that's inappropriate. And we want to be a community where we can heal those spiritual wounds. And that keeps the conversation solely about Christianity. And we need to figure out a way to look at the larger piece. Well, these stories are also Jewish, and we might even say we're previously Jewish, right? In the moments when the timeline matters. And so I think that that's actually really tricky for congregations to navigate. And I think that a lot for our colleagues who don't necessarily come from Judaism or come with a lot of experience navigating that, I think we need to look at like, how do we support congregational maturation around that? It's not actually something that we are born knowing how to do. Because I think that there is a maturational point that I suspect you might be talking about, Meg, where congregations are really interested in Judaism and they understand that it's distinct from other traditions and that it comes with a lot of richness, and even that it's a source tradition. And then the question becomes like, well, how do we appropriately listen to it? And do we listen to Jewish stories without listening to Jewish people? Or do we want a Jewish person to legitimize the fact that we don't care about the Jewish stories? Or, you know, what are we building towards? And how can we do it in a way that is that's democratic and that's flexible, right? That takes into account who's on the ground in leadership and, you know, in the area, but also how are we accountable to some of these larger ideas and to the history of how this stuff has gone in our movement and in the world?
So I really take seriously the notion that Jewishness and Judaism is a source, not just in loving our neighbor as ourselves, which seems kind of Christianizing the whole Jewish message, but because it's a source. And maybe because Lee and I grew up in the wonderfulness of Unitarian Universalist religious education, yay. Early on, I got to be part of lots of different faith celebrations, and regardless of whether a person from that faith community was necessarily in the room. In terms of something like a Seder, there have been Seders in almost every community I have served. Some have many Jewish people. One congregation I served, I think it was me, my husband, and my son were the only Jews, and I felt like we were performing. But there was an intention to really get it. And Jews screw up Seders. Is that a horrible thing to say, Leah? We do all kinds of weird things. Like, there's all kinds of ways. And I, you know, sometimes the local Reconstructionist Jewish synagogue adds so many things to the, you know, list of things they're celebrating in the Seder, I don't even understand. The plate has gotten so large, by the way, beyond oranges. I mean, and, you know, it's like the song Tradition from Fiddler on the Roof. I go, whoa, like tradition. But what I'm saying is it's an evolving thing. I think we need to be less afraid of it. I think we're going to screw up. We all screw up. And the only person that ever called me on doing a Seder wrong was a non-Jewish person who had come as a guest of somebody in my Atlanta congregation who really questioned the whole orange thing. She said, well, I went to one before and there wasn't an orange. My experience, seriously, is that Jews within our congregations are so happy that Jewish rituals are being shared. They are. I haven't had anybody come up to me and say, you screwed it up. They say, thank you, thank you, thank you for doing it. So I'm into encouraging people to try to do it and not being so worried about appropriation. I think erring on the side of, you know, in good intention, doing those traditions.
I think also we could even expand. I love your notion of just like, yeah, we mess up and that's okay. I think that's so ironically lost in religious communities sometimes. And I think we could even expand that to say, there's a lot of different ways that we enact and perform and embody Judaism or whatever it is that we're talking about. And I think that part of the, part of being from a marginalized identity or community is that people want you to be a monolith, right? Like, I'm raising Black children and married to a Black person. And people have this very small idea of what, like, a Black person in Unitarian Universalism should want, feel, and desire. And the reality is that it's, you know, my partner doesn't speak for every single person with African blood in our movement, right? And that seems obvious, but she's not always treated that way. And I think that there's a lot of ways to be Jewish. I think we're past the point of saying like the immigrant experience or even talking about these important religious trends, that we're kind of past the point of talking about Christianity and Judaism and Islam, that these are all plural by now. And so you come from a version of a Christianities, right, that may or may not be different than the person who's one state or one pew over. And I think that that's equally true about Judaism and Jewish expression, and that there's a lot of different ways to be Jewish and to do Jewish stuff. And there's, I don't know if this is a blessing or a curse, but there's a lot of ways to do it well, and there's a lot of ways to do it awkwardly. And I participate in all places on that spectrum.
Yeah, I just want to tag on and say about the screwing up. I think, so what I'm talking about most specifically is how much you can screw up the Hebrew. I mean, you can. Like, I'm terrible. I mean, I am just awful. But our son, Ben, we must have spent several thousand dollars to tutor him for his bar mitzvah. So long as he was living at home, we expected him to get up at the Seder and do the Hebrew because we had made an investment in it. That's what I'm talking about. It's like, you know, we have a colleague I won't name, but he's wonderful, who grew up Baptist and he's really steeped in Judaism. I've done services at GA with him when I said, I'm the bad Jew. This guy knows so much more about Torah than I do, and he really speaks Hebrew better than me. But there's just so many ways to do this. That's what I'm talking about. And to just be okay with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of being one of the only non-Jews at a Seder for Passover for years. And at first I was shocked by the irreverence and the people who just were drinking and laughing. But the Seder, the order is still there. It's just that so is a lot of the stuff on the sides. And that actually relaxed me more about seeing what was happening with Unitarian Universalists. Because if non-Jews were doing that, it could be seen as really disrespectful given the culture that we're part of, right? I mean, given the disregard for Jewish tradition. So it's, you know, it's like everything. We're all going to do it imperfectly and we're all going to find our way. Lee, I was wondering, you brought up being married to a Black woman and having Black children. And as you're watching kind of the intersectionality, I mean, I've even heard from rabbis that I'm friends with that the word intersectionality they're not allowed to use it because of the linkages in Black Lives Matter with pro-Palestine. And I don't want to talk about the Middle East, but I'm curious if you see those domestic, I was really troubled that the whole word intersectionality was being reduced to that. And maybe from Appleton, it's hard to even see what's going on in the bigger world in that way. But I'm curious how you and your partner kind of negotiate some of that intersectional territory that I'm sure you do every day.
Well, I personally don't object to that word. I think it's important to talk. I mean, Marty, you said that words matter, and they do.
I would never think that you guys would object to that word. Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's, but I think it is important to keep like interrogating language, like how or if has this word changed? Does it still suit our purposes? I mean, it's still a concept that, I mean, I think is well described, you know, using that term. I think that, you know, I have a complicated family. I'm queer. I'm multi-religious. My spouse is multi-religious in her own way. We're foster parents. So we bring with us all of the spiritual experiences of kids who've had a lot of other different families and are currently making a family with us. And I think that our faith statement and the way that we choose to live is that complexity is a gift. It's a gift for us, and it's a gift that we offer the world, and that we're complex in different ways. So part of the theology of complexity for me is not thinking that the ways that I'm complex are the same ways that my children or my spouse experience complexity, right? Because complexity isn't always the same thing, but that we're all people who contain multitudes, and that can be very painful. We're not seen as a family in so many different ways that are big and that are little. And the pain of that can really chip away at your spirit. But it's also a blessing because we are large and multifaceted enough to weave something that's really strong. And that's what you need for this world. Strength. That's spiritual enough to be, to not be rigid. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah. So what spiritual practices help you with that? Because it is really hard. What you're saying is really hard work. So I'm curious if there are prayers or practices or how you create that together. Cause that's really beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. I would love to hear from anyone who has spiritual practices that they think would support what I'm trying to do. For us, it's about, we do a lot of Judaism in the home. We take Shabbat observances really seriously. Everyone has their job. And we try to bring as much like beauty and intention to that as possible. And part of what I've just learned as a parent, is about how important repetition is. And it's funny because I've been a religious person my whole life and I'm a professional religious leader. So before I would have said something like ritual is important, but now I really understand that on a whole new level, and that we do the Seder with our friends, but then we also do the Seder again at home. And something about being together and being able to repeat and re-engage the same ideas, the same stories is comforting to me as an adult, and is also a strategy against trauma. It's a trauma-informed strategy for children who have encountered trauma, for the adults in the family who have and do encounter the trauma of oppression and other things. And so the kind of embodied prayer that looks like rituals together, even the same silent prayer at dinner and our routine of everyone saying their best and their worst thing that happened. These are ways that we pray and that we continue to pray.
Aisha, I'm curious if something comes in for you there, because you're also in a really complex family. And
oh, yeah. I was thinking about the first Seder after we got married, and I have one uncle who didn't disown me out of my huge, enormous Muslim Egyptian family. And he and his wife and my aunt came to dinner at my mother-in-law's house, and we did the whole Seder, but the parts that referenced Egypt enslaving the Jewish people, she kept apologizing and saying this was, you know, a metaphor. I mean, she was very, my husband's family is very secular. So she's like, my uncle's name, of course, is Muhammad. So she's like, Muhammad, this is not offense to Egypt. You know, this was written a long time ago. It was actually one of the funniest Seders to this day that I've ever attended. And we've been to several. What's fascinating for me is watching my children embrace the complexity of my husband, the decisions my husband and I made. And my daughter, who's 20, is not a huge fan of Unitarian Universalism, but has been going to Hillel, the, I guess it's a campus ministry of the Judaism, because there's Hillel. So she's gone to Seder there on her college campus. But then she also went to the UCC church for Easter, which I found fascinating near her. But she won't touch the Unitarians right now. She needs to rebel. And my son is more fluid and kind of goes along with whatever. But in our family, what's funny is my husband would be annoyed at me if I forgot when Hanukkah started. And I'm like, dude, this is your realm. Like, I can try to remember, but watching my children and my daughter, you know, would love to go to Israel and do a birthright trip, and kind of watching their journey and trying to support them. And I'm grateful that I, you know, am so entrenched, you know, part of Unitarian Universalism in the way I am, because I'm able to support that journey in the way that's important for them. But what I didn't expect is my daughter, especially to seek the Jewish faith, because my husband and his family, I mean, they ate pork, so they were incredibly secular. we had the mezuzahs. When you were talking about the mezuzah, you know, when we bought, when my first husband and I first got married and had a house, my mother-in-law, the first thing she did was got us a mezuzah. So, and she spoke Yiddish, so I knew some Yiddish words, which was hysterical. So it's it makes for such a much more rich and, you know, exciting in some ways, life, and painful. I mean, it is painful watching. I mean, we're Arab Jews. My children are half both. And so I heard we don't want to talk about the Middle East, but it's hard to separate that and kind of see the pain of people that we have a lot more in common than we don't. And it feels like, can't we just get along, you know? And so there's kind of deep pain about that for me. And my children are just embracing so much, and it gives me hope, and it's what kind of drives me to embrace Unitarian Universalism and hope that we can make this work. And so, I don't know if that answered your question, but we do have a lot of fun with it, my family.
Yeah. Marty, how about you?
What's the original question?
Just what kind of ritual life sustains the complexity of, I heard from you, secular, Jewish, Unitarian Universalist in your family.
I do. I think the Jewish holidays and sharing it with non-Jews and being very careful to point out the really screwed up stories. I mean, that Exodus story is seriously screwed up. It really is. I mean, it totally is. Hanukkah, that's a totally screwed up holiday, you know. And I think the one thing I love about being a non-Orthodox, and I don't get me started about Orthodoxy in any sense, but, you know, a non-Orthodox progressive Jew, is that that's perfectly okay. And I would love people to understand who aren't Jewish how much that goes on, right, Lee? I mean, it just goes on. And Aisha, it goes on, you know? And so we get a chance to say, this is what works in this holiday. For me, it's inviting Elijah and Miriam. Those are the cool parts of that whole thing. The Exodus story has problems. Hanukkah, and please don't light all 8 candles at the same time, but like doing that. Yom Kippur is one of my totally favorite things. And seriously speaking, we ought to be doing some more of the Jewish holidays besides the big two. I think Yom Kippur has a quality of talking about a forgiveness and apology and atonement that is just so stunning to me. It's just it's absolutely my favorite time. And to be able to share it with non-Jews is something that I have as a Unitarian Universalist clergy that I really value. So yeah. And my whole family now, my children did not marry Jews. They didn't. They married, my daughter married a WASP off the Mayflower. My older boy married a Chinese national, and my youngest boy is living with a Puerto Rican Catholic. And so that's already a rich thing. So I think that's the reality.
I wanted to be sure to ask you all a question. I also asked the folks visiting as Christian New Year's, what if you could stop Unitarian Universalists from saying one thing to you that they say when they you know, when you're just like, oh please, may I never hear this again? What would that be?
Only one thing.
Just one, yeah.
Go for it.
I think it would be something along the lines of Unitarian Universalism is the place where you can just believe anything. But I also want to say I also want to say that tenderly, with a lot of respect for how hard it is to figure out in an increasingly secularized society how to really express these religious ideas. So I don't mean any disrespect towards people who do say or have said those things. I'm a congregational minister, and I too experience it as very difficult to figure out how to language this stuff in good ways. But I think that that's an area where we have to push past the easy phrase.
For me right now, and it's hard for me to say it, it's I don't want to hear too many more times that after all, we began as a product of the Christian religion. I don't think that's helpful. And it discounts so many people now, and even so many people it's a long time, long, long time since that's been true. And it isn't helpful. And furthermore, in terms of even market niche, it isn't even helpful. What we do offer is our interreligiousness. What we do offer is our ability to try to figure out how to celebrate, honor, discuss, debate different traditions. And so that is the one thing lately that's just been very unhelpful for me to hear.
Yeah, it's a painful conversation. And I think I could add that social media is not a helpful place to have it. I think some deeper conversations need to happen. One thing that I see is that we've had a lot of different guests. The Christians feel discounted and pushed aside by everyone. The humanists feel discounted and pushed aside. You're mentioning feeling, I think we're just trying to figure out how to really be that interreligious center that we want to. And if we could see the commonalities in those experiences and try to find language to hold everybody, I feel like we could just have a lot more meaningful conversations. Last words.
Well, I really like your impulse to end on wanting to see those commonalities, because I think there are a lot. And I think we could all, from most perspectives, do better at listening. But I think one thing that's missing from liberal theology and from this part of the conversation is a power analysis. That part of how we become positioned enough to deeply listen to ourselves, to others, to the silences, is that we have an analysis of power. Who has it? Who has had it? Are we pro-power? Are we anti-power? How do we know if power is being used wisely? Does it move? Does it get stuck? And I think that one of my frustrations with this conversation, and yes, social media, not a great place to have it, is that there's totally absent a power analysis. So it becomes a contest to see who can shriek the most shrilly. And I just don't really see that benefits any of us, the shriekers or the shrieked at.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
I guess what I'd want to say is what I found from my original studies and has been substantiated is for most Jews, they really are happy they found Unitarian Universalism. And they're also happy to continue to identify as being Jewish. I haven't experienced the woundedness much. They really feel like they've come to a good place. So I feel like the accommodations we might be asking for are small related to the fact that Jews really, really want to be with us. They really feel like that we're a really good place to have found.
That's great. Well, thanks so much to both of you. Thanks for all that you do, for the book that you did together about this, which people can buy, which Jessica can promote over on the Facebook page. And next week, I think we're going to have, I'm working hard to have some folks from down here in Mexico who are creating ways to welcome deported nationals here, some of the Unitarian Universalists. So they really want to connect up with people doing sanctuary work in the U.S. And hey, I'm here. So hopefully that's what we're working towards for next week. So I don't have names yet, but it's going to happen. Thank you so much. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.